Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated Tuesday, June 20th, 2017. We will begin today's reading with a front page story headlined, Kids' Interest Gives Rise to New Exhibit. Robertson Charter School Class Brings Harlem Renaissance to a Decatur Museum. It is datelined Decatur. Nevaeh Woods may not be an expert on the Harlem Renaissance, but she's heard of it. Woods, a 10-year-old who just finished fourth grade at Robertson Charter School, also knows about the existence of the African American Cultural and Genealogical Society Museum of Illinois. That was the goal of Robertson teacher Sanji Sturdivant's class project last year, during which the fourth and fifth graders raised money for a new exhibit in the museum about the Harlem Renaissance, a movement in Harlem, New York in the 1920s that saw the rise of numerous black entertainers, writers, and activists. The exhibit recently opened in the upstairs portion of the museum. I feel that I was like a part of that, Woods said, looking at the exhibit. It feels real to me now. The new exhibit has 17 individual placards featuring biographical information about the Harlem Renaissance and the cast of entertainers, writers, and activists who made significant contributions, including Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Langston Hughes. Students in Sturdivant's Mastering Academic Desire and Drive Lab, MADD, raised more than $1,000 for the exhibit, which was made by Dynagraphics Printing in Decatur. The idea for the exhibit began with a life-size mannequin of Holiday that was already in possession of museum founder and curator Evelyn Hood. It stands next to the new part of the exhibit. Evelyn already had her, and when I first saw it, I said, well, maybe one day we could do the Harlem Renaissance, Sturdivant said. And we thought it was a great idea to teach the kids about this period of rebirth in the arts, as well as the political and social areas. There were a lot of people from that era this generation won't know about unless he exposes them to these kids. This was the second year in a row Sturdivant's MADD lab had raised money for an exhibit. Last year's exhibit was on the National Panhellenic Council, 9 historically black fraternities and sororities, commonly known as the Divine Nine, and is also on the second floor of the museum. Sturdivant said she was inspired to raise money because of the new exhibits by Rich Hansen's African American Experience class at Mount Zion High School, which has created 6 exhibits for the museum. I remember sitting at home the summer before last, trying to think of something that would last all year long and be impactful, Sturdivant said. I was reading through the Herald and Review archives, and I saw something about Rich Hansen in Mount Zion and thought I could do that too. Sturdivant reached out to Hood, who thought it was a great idea. It's been one of my goals to reach the youth, Hood said. I want our history to stay alive, so it has to be passed on to the younger generation. Students in the MAD lab this year did research projects on the Harlem Renaissance and also performed Cab Calloway's Minnie the Moocher in December, with students dressing in period clothing, and had a reading of a Hughes poem. Money was raised through social media, sending flyers home, and a little ingenuity, especially from fifth grader-to-be Anthony White. Every day he was bringing in dollars, and I was like, where are you getting this money from? Sturdivant said, laughing. White said he did every chore he could think of to earn the money. I took out the trash, I swept, I did everything, White said. He said he'd never heard of the Harlem Renaissance before the project, but learned quite a bit. There were a lot of famous people, dancers, musicians, singers, a lot of stuff, White said. Woods said her mom had a jeans day on a Friday for a $1 donation to raise money, And she went to Bob Brady Auto Mall, where her dad works, and along with some other students, gave a presentation to the sales team about the Harlem Renaissance, which earned a donation. Woods, who also hadn't heard of the Harlem Renaissance before the project, said in her research she learned about Holiday. She was a famous jazz singer, Woods said. I feel like I'd heard singers from them at the store. You know how they play the music over the speakers at the store? I feel like I'd heard them there, but I didn't know who they were. Robertson principal Nikki Fenderson said every class at Robertson is required to do a community service project. Other projects have included volunteering at nursing homes, the Decatur-Macon County Senior Center, Scoville Zoo's Boo at the Zoo, and the Macon County Animal Control and Care Center, as well as sending cards and letters to veterans. It's anything where the students connect with an organization or agency to give back, Fenderson said. It's important our students understand the importance of giving back and being productive. And it's also important that they learn and understand about African American culture. Sturdivant said she's already in the planning phase for next year's project on the ancient Egyptians. Like Hood, Sturdivant said she sees potential for bigger and better things for the museum. I think this could be a great place, a tourist attraction, Sturdivant said. It's not just for African Americans. It's a great place for us all to come and stimulate conversation and have those discussions that squash stereotypes. And there is a little additional part to this story about the Harlem Renaissance, and it says, after hundreds of thousands of African Americans migrated from the rural South to the urban North in the 1890s, a movement started in Harlem, New York, in the 1920s that saw the rise of numerous black entertainers, writers, and activists. Most new migrants to the North ended up segregated by practice in rundown urban slums. The largest of these was Harlem, where a cultural revolution was created that mixed old traditions with new. It was known then as the New Negro Movement and is now called the Harlem Renaissance. From the early 1920s through the 1930s, writers like Langston Hughes and Gene Toomer, singers like Bessie Smith and Billie Holiday, musicians like Louis Armstrong and Jelly Roll Morton, and dancers like Bill Bojangles Robinson and the Nicholas Brothers were among the hundreds influential in the movement. The Harlem Renaissance brought entertainment to blacks and whites alike, firmly establishing African American culture as a part of the American culture as a whole. The next front page story we're going to read is headlined, Farmers Remind Davis That Crop Insurance Essential to Their Livelihood. Dateline Decatur. As U.S. Representative Rodney Davis prepares to work on the next farm bill, farmers in his district stress the importance of crop insurance to their livelihood. The crop insurance is fundamentally important for risk management, said Jared Hooker, District 10 Director at the Illinois Soybean Association. The prices right now were basically underwater price-wise. So we buy crop insurance at least for our yields, and the government helps us with part of the premiums being subsidized. And that is very important for us. We all want to survive. Hooker was among about a dozen people who spent early Monday morning at the University of Illinois Extension Office at Richland Community College to talk with Davis about the federal government's role in agriculture. The stop was just one that the Taylorville Republican is holding across the 14 counties in the 13th Congressional District as lawmakers discuss ways to improve on the current farm bill. That bill, which became law in 2014, provided nearly $500 billion of federal funding overall and reformed various programs, from crop insurance funding to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, the latter of which makes up the majority of the bill's spending. A new farm bill is generally passed every 5 years, with the current one set to expire at the end of 2018. Davis said he and others on the House Agricultural Committee will spend the rest of this year talking with constituents about the current plan and suggested changes. The hope is to have a bill ready by next year. The farm bill is a vehicle for us to put these policies that help our agricultural community, Davis said. Those in the audience at Richland expressed support for several of the current protections provided by the Farm Bill, specifically for agricultural research and for the federal subsidies for crop insurance premiums that Davis called the backbone of the legislation. The insurance protects farms from the loss of crops due to natural disasters such as hail, drought, and floods, or the loss of revenue due to declines in the prices of agricultural commodities. Davis downplayed one attendee's concerns about the recent budget proposal from President Donald Trump, which called for $46.54 billion in cuts to federal funding for the agriculture sector over the next 10 years, and limiting the federal subsidies for crop insurance premiums. Congress needs to exert its privilege in approving a budget, said Davis, who added he would vote against Trump's budget as proposed. One thing that Rick Harris hopes to see in any future farm bill is a way for the federal government to make it easier for prospective farmers to enter the field. Harris, who owns 20 acres of farmland in Macon County, said there has to be a way to retain young farmers who might be stifled by the often staggering costs to maintain an operation. I don't know who the next generation is that is going to be able to afford to farm, Harris said. Davis alluded to Monday's event as a return to normalcy after last week when a gunman opened fire at a GOP congressional baseball practice in Alexandria, Virginia, wounding House GOP Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana and several others. Davis, who was at the Wednesday morning practice, was unharmed. Monday felt like any other local congressional event, with no visible security and only a few mentions of the shooting during the hour-long visit. Afterward, Davis said he was looking forward to working with Republicans and Democrats on the farm bill. What people in America don't realize is that we do get along, and the farm bill we discussed today is a bipartisan bill, Davis said after the meeting. That is how we actually put our policy differences aside. We legislate. And a little addition to this story about the farm bill says, the farm bill is a multi-year law that governs many agricultural and food programs. Titles in the most recent bill included farm commodity price and income supports, agricultural conservation, farm credit, trade, research, rural development, bioenergy, foreign food aid, and domestic nutrition assistance. The current farm bill expires at the end of 2018, and the source for that was the Congressional Research Service. And just a short correction about school vaccinations. School vaccination clinics today are at the Macon County Health Department. A brief in the Saturday, June 17 edition had the incorrect location, the newspaper aired. And now we move to the local section of the paper with a story headlined, Decatur Leaders Going to Washington, Dateline Decatur. A delegation of Decatur area business and labor leaders are joining Mayor Julie Moore Wolf in Washington this week to lobby for transportation money. The hope is to generate support for a slew of big-ticket infrastructure projects that would establish Decatur as a major Midwest trade hub. The trip comes after the Decatur City Council, during Monday's meeting, approved an extension of an engineering study regarding improvements for the Midwest Inland Port. The study was first greenlighted in 2014, but state funding fell through before it was completed. The potential to improve access to the multimodal port is just one item in the larger vision to increase road, rail, and air shipping in Decatur. The local coalition will be meeting with both U.S. senators from Illinois, U.S. Department of Transportation officials, and two congressmen, Representative Mike Quigley, D. Chicago, and Representative Rick Nolan, Democrat of Minnesota, who both serve on committees with the key to federal transportation dollars. Wolf said she wanted to include big business, labor unions, and officials from Macon County to show how unified the area's players are around the infrastructure vision. It's a pretty powerful message when you have business and labor, city and county, together with one purpose and one goal, all on the same page, Wolf said. City Manager Tim Gleason said it's important to make their case with a new administration in Washington. Even if we wouldn't get what's in play now, we are telling a compelling story. People take notice, he said. The Obama administration extended a grant program for such projects. Decatur became a finalist last year, but ultimately did not win out. Gleason said the Trump administration has shrunk that program, which means competition for federal dollars in the short term even more tight. But President Donald Trump has called at times for a major federal infrastructure plan. I think they are gearing up for their own infrastructure plan, Gleason said. In the meantime, Gleason is reaching out to organizations and businesses in the area to help fill the funding hole left for the inland port study. The extension of the city's permission to conduct the study allows Decatur to keep $180,000 from the Illinois Department of Transportation. Gleason and Wolf are hoping that they will be able to come up with the $45,000 needed in short order. I have full faith in the city manager to come up with that money. He might have a bake sale or something, Wolf said. And Gleason said he has already reached out to the Economic Development Corporation of Decatur and Macon County. And the timeline for their project is February 2015, Decatur engineering firm was chosen to conduct the study of the inland port improvements. In June of 2015, the city stops the study when state government fails to enact a budget. State agencies lose funding after no budget is enacted in Springfield. And in June of 2017, the city approves an extension of the study's contract another year. This gives the city more time to find the missing $36,000 in grants. Our next story is titled, Arson Dog Maisie Shows Off Her Skills in Bloomington. It is Dateline Bloomington. As a trained fire investigator with the Illinois State Fire Marshal's Office, Shane Arndt knows that when he sees a thick plume of smoke or reads a news report about a major fire, he might as well start heading to the scene. Showing up alone, though, isn't enough. There's little point in going if his new four-legged companion, Maisie, isn't there. Maisie, a certified arson dog, is a four-year-old yellow Labrador who has been trained to sniff out accelerants used to start fires. Both were on hand Monday at the Bloomington Fire Department training site for a demonstration. If arson is suspected, we can go through a house in about 5 to 10 minutes, Arndt said. During the demonstration, which included an indoor and outdoor scenario, officials placed a few drops of accelerant for Maisie to find. After an initial walkthrough of the area, Maisie went to work, and once she found the accelerant, she stopped, came to a sit position, and pointed her nose in the direction of the accelerant. It's what is called a passive alert. Our local fire districts and municipalities depend on us and our investigators to assist with investigations, State Fire Marshal Matt Perez said. We couldn't do it without the arson dogs. The program was established in 1993 through the sponsorship of State Farm, and over the past 24 years, more than 380 teams have been trained and placed in 45 states, the District of Columbia, and Canada. State Farm continues to sponsor the program. It costs about $25,000 to purchase the dog and train the dog and handler. The canines are all Labrador Retrievers or Goldadors, a Labrador and Golden Retriever mix, because they have a superior ability to discriminate scents at a fire scene. Labs also have a good disposition and an outgoing personality, said Heather Paul, a public relations specialist with State Farm. They are very active and have a love-to-work type of attitude. Canines such as Maisie are trained through a food reward method, Arndt said. They only eat from the hand of their handler while training or working. They live and retire at the home of their handlers. For Arndt, Maisie is the fourth dog he's worked with. On Monday, he also brought Rusty, a 10-year-old chocolate lab who recently retired. Rusty is just beginning to learn to eat from a bowl, which is very different than what he has done his entire life, Arndt said. But Maisie is the first female I have worked with, and so it's going to be interesting to see what differences there are. The canines and handlers are required to complete 200 hours and 4 weeks of training by the Maine State Police before they are qualified for investigations. They are required to be recertified every year to remain a certified accelerant detection canine team. The benchmark is 100% accuracy, Arndt said. Even with today's sophisticated equipment available for detectives, Arndt said he prefers the accuracy of the trained dogs. I trust arson dogs more because I have worked with them for years, he said. Just because she might alert at a fire, though, doesn't necessarily mean that it is an intentionally set fire. We still have work to do. We have to determine what it was she picked up on and investigate that portion of it. But the dogs are a great tool and can point us in the right direction. There are 7 arson dogs working with the State Fire Marshal's office. And there is a photograph accompanying this story of the dog, Maisie, giving a very affectionate lick to a person at the scene. And the caption says, unlike many highly trained police or military dogs, Maisie, an arson dog, seems to enjoy sharing affection with anyone around her, as she gives Heather Paul, State Farm Insurance Arson Dog Program Coordinator, a lick Monday at the Bloomington Fire Department training site. Arson dogs are highly valued because of their ability to find exact locations where fire accelerants are used to start a fire. And here are the local briefs for Tuesday, June 20. In Decatur, school vaccinations. The Macon County Health Department will extend its school vaccination clinics. They will be 8:30 to 11:30 a.m. and 1 to 6 p.m. today at the Macon County Health Department at 1221 East Condit Street. No appointment is necessary. For information, call 217-423-6988. Extension 1333. In Bement, a fatal train accident. The Illinois State Police said a 14-year-old male bicyclist died Sunday afternoon after he was struck by a freight train in Bement. A statement from Trooper Tracy Lillard said the accident happened at 2:15 p.m. at the crossing on Pyatt Street and involved a Norfolk Southern Corporation train. Initial reports indicate a 14-year-old was attempting to cross the railroad tracks at the railroad crossing and was struck by the passing freight train, Lillard added. The accident remained under investigation. And in Decatur, a crash kills a motorcyclist. The motorcyclist who died after a collision with a car in Decatur Saturday night has been named as Anthony J. Hart, age 21, of rural Oakley. Macon County Coroner Michael E. Day said Hart died at 4:19 a.m. Sunday as surgeons fought to save him at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Day said Hart had suffered massive internal injuries in the 9:30 p.m. crash on Country Club Road near U.S. 36. The results of routine toxicology testing are pending and an inquest will be held. Decatur Police Lieutenant Brad Allen said Hart had been northbound on Country Club Road and the driver of the car had been stopped at the exit of the Lakeview Motel. The motorcyclist left the roadway and collided with the driver's side of the car, Allen said. The crash remained under investigation. And in Decatur, SUV left flat in street. Police said a Decatur driver came back to find her sport utility vehicle lying flat in the street after all four wheels and tires had been stolen early Sunday. Sergeant Christopher Copeland said the wheels and tires, together worth more than $500, were taken between 2 and 6 a.m. while the vehicle was parked in the 1900 block of North Union Street. And in Decatur, police warn of scam. Some scammers are so bold or reckless, they even call Decatur police while working the phones. Sergeant Christopher Copeland said the callers can target anyone with a landline or cell phone, and they claim to be from the Internal Revenue Service. The callers demand money by trying to frighten people into believing they are facing pending criminal charges for back taxes. Copeland said the IRS does not call taxpayers without giving the opportunity to dispute amounts owed. It also doesn't demand particular methods of payment or threaten to call local police. Copeland's advice to anyone receiving such a call is to hang up. The IRS website has advice on dealing with scams. Decatur police do not investigate this type of case, Copeland said. And in Decatur, a trailer was reported stolen. A trailer valued at $7,000 was reported stolen Sunday morning from the backyard of a house in the 1500 block of East North Street. Police Sergeant Christopher Copeland said the black 16-foot hydraulic dump trailer was taken about 8:40 a.m. And this story is titled, No Timetable Set for Krekel's Reopen After Fire. The Krekel's Custard at 2320 East Main Street will rise again, but it could take a few months, employee Taylor James said. The rear corner of the building caught fire Friday afternoon, and Decatur residents were following closely on social media, sharing their memories and concerns as firefighters worked to contain the fire. At the scene Friday, Decatur Fire Chief Jeff Abbott said he suspected the cause was electrical, and a reopen date, well, it'll take a couple of months, maybe late August or September. We will take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review. Please stay tuned.